Thanks very much, Peter. And it's a pleasure to be following the Treasurer in talking about the outlook for the economy in 2007. While the Treasurer, appropriately enough, has been focusing on the Tasmanian economic outlook, and if time permits, I may have my two bobs worth on that, but I think I can be of most help to people here today by talking about the international and national outlook, so that's what I'll do. And starting with the international outlook, the key point I want to make is that we are living through what will probably turn out to be the longest period of above-trend growth in the global economy in more than 30 years. In two of the last 3 years, growth in the world economy has exceeded 5%, and although a slowdown in the American economy, that's partly the result of America's housing market having arrived over the last 12 months at the same point that the housing markets in Eastern Australia arrived at in 2004, that although that will mean a slowdown in the American economy, there is enough growth elsewhere in the developed world and particularly in the developing world to ensure that global growth exceeds 4% this year and next. And that means that by the end of 2008, we'll have had 6 years in a row of growth in the world economy of more than 4% per annum, which we haven't had since the 6 years ended 1973, which of course were terminated by the first oil shock of September, October of that year, which makes this six-year period all the more remarkable because it has, of course, incorporated what many people describe as the third oil shock. And certainly between 2002 and the middle of last year, oil prices in rising from $20 to almost $70 a barrel rose proportionately by as much as they did during the first oil shock when they went from about $3 to $9 US a barrel at that time. As this chart kind of indicates, if you look at the divergence between the green line and the thick blue line, increasingly growth in the world economy is being driven by the developing economies rather than by the so-called advanced economies concentrated in North America, Western Europe, Japan, Australia, and stretching the definition of advanced just a little bit, New Zealand is included in that category. And there are three dimensions of that that I really want to emphasise. One is just a matter of mathematics, that the developing and advanced economies each represent about 50% of global GDP today. Of course, the developing economies have about 80% of the world's population, so per capita GDP is almost by definition much lower there than it is in the advanced world. But notice that over the past few years, the developing world has accounted for almost two-thirds of the growth in global GDP, and the advanced world only about one-third of the growth in global GDP. And those proportions are roughly the inverse of what they were during the 1980s and early part of the 1990s. And there's nothing on the horizon in the developing world that suggests that's about to change. But there are actually two other important ways in which things that are happening in the developing economies are contributing to faster growth in the industrialized world and hence in the world as a whole, than would otherwise be possible. One of those is that developing countries are now providing a source of competitive discipline on the pricing of goods, services, and labour in the Western world that didn't exist at the time of the first two oil shocks, partly thanks to their growing ability to produce an increasing range of more sophisticated goods and services that wasn't the case 25, 30 years ago, and partly because the combination of globalisation and technology has made it much more possible to get goods and services produced in the developing world into advanced country markets. It's no longer possible for producers and workers in rich countries to play pass the parcel with shocks such as an increase in oil prices in the way that they did 25 and 30 years ago. 25 and 30 years ago, when oil prices doubled and then or trebled and then doubled again about 5 years later, most businesses were able to pass on the impact of higher energy or transport costs to their customers in the form of higher prices, knowing that they could recoup, they needn't worry about losses of market share because they could go to the government and get a tariff increase to protect them from potential competition from other countries. And similarly, workers knew that they could go to the boss, or in this country, the Arbitration Commission, and demand a pay rise to compensate them for increased fuel costs because their bosses would grant that, knowing that they could jack prices up in response to that as well. Today, of course, businesses know, unless they're in a monopoly position like Qantas, that they can't pass on the impact of higher petrol or fuel or transport costs for fear of losing market share. And workers similarly know that if they push for wage increases that aren't justified by productivity gains, then there's probably no surer thing they could do that would result in their jobs being done at a half or a third of the wage by someone in India, China, Vietnam or Thailand or somewhere like that. And so in contrast to the spikes in inflation and hence in interest rates, which followed the first two oil shocks, the rise in oil prices and in other commodity prices over the last 2 or 3 years has not been followed by a generalised surge in inflation, hence has allowed interest rates to stay much lower than would have been the case otherwise, and hence high oil prices haven't caused the recessions which history might have led you otherwise to expect. The second way in which developments in the developing countries are helping to promote faster growth in the developed world is that, contrary to experience and to the predictions of textbooks, capital is, as it were, flowing uphill in the world economy today. That is, rather than flowing from rich countries where you might think all of the obvious opportunities for profitable investment have already been exploited, to areas of the world where, in theory, there should be plenty of opportunities to do new things and make money out of it, capital is now flowing from poor countries to rich countries. And that's partly because in the aftermath of the financial crises that affected various parts of the developing world in the second half of the 90s, investment, physical investment, has been surprisingly low. As a result of investment being lower than saving, most countries, including more recently oil exporting nations, have begun running large current account surpluses. But as a policy choice by most of those countries, instead of allowing those rising current account surpluses to be reflected in rising values of their currencies against the US dollar, they've instead chosen to maintain, either rigidly in the case of Russia and other oil producing nations, or without much scope for movement in the case of China and other East Asian nations, relatively fixed exchange rates against the US dollar. And in order to maintain those, in the face of mushrooming current account surpluses, their central banks have bought massive amounts of US dollars in particular, and with the massive amounts of US dollars they've bought equivalently massive amounts of US and other fixed income government securities, allowing governments in the US and elsewhere to finance their budget deficits at lower interest rates than would otherwise have been possible. And that, of course, has been supplemented more recently by similarly massive capital flows out of Japan, partly, as you may have read in the financial press of late, by professional investors borrowing in yen in order to buy assets denominated in other currencies because the cost of borrowing in yen is so minuscule. But more importantly, because ordinary Japanese who've lived through a decade of zero or negative inflation and, as a result, zero or barely positive interest rates have slowly begun to discover that in exchange for taking on currency risk, which has actually worked in their favour over the last decade anyway, they can do somewhat better than the miserable 0.25 or more recently 0.5% per annum available by keeping their money in Japanese banks. The Bank of Japan, as you may recall, 3 weeks ago raised its cash rate by a quarter of a percentage point to 0.5%. Japanese investors have, as I say, begun to discover that if you put money in Australian or New Zealand dollar denominated instruments, for example, you can get 5.25% or in New Zealand as much as 7.5% for no risk other than the exchange rate, which for Japanese investors has actually yielded them about 50% in addition by way of capital gain. So there are now capital flows of upwards of $500 billion a year coming out of Japan, on top of the over $1 trillion a year coming out of developing countries, enabling countries like the United States, but also Britain, Australia, Spain and New Zealand, among others, to finance their deficits at lower exchange rates, at lower interest rates and more stable exchange rates than would otherwise have been possible. You can see this particularly by looking at the way in which long-term bond rates, which remember are set in financial markets by forces of supply and demand, have remained almost unmoved by a huge increase in the cash rate in the world's leading industrialised countries, which is set by central banks according to their perception of the requirements for monetary policy. Ordinarily, in the face of a rise in the average cash rate across the industrialised world from about 1.5% to 4%, you wouldn't have expected long-term bond rates to have been almost unchanged at around 4%. Yet, that's what's happened. Because in most countries, apart from Australia and Britain, mortgages are at fixed rates and price off the long end rather than the official cash rate, mortgage rates have been lower in most industrialised countries than would otherwise have been the case, allowing housing booms to go on for longer and consumers to borrow more at lower rates in order to spend than would otherwise have been the case. Because the bond yield is used by many companies as a benchmark for determining whether a proposed investment is worth going ahead with or not, the stable long-term bond rate has resulted in more corporate investment projects being ticked off than would otherwise have been the case by directors and managements. And the low level of interest rates has encouraged investors to go out further along the risk curve, buying more risky assets such as stocks or corporate and emerging market debt, making those instruments less volatile and trading at narrower spreads over risk-free assets like government bonds. And indeed, I would argue that turbulence in financial markets over the last couple of weeks, prompted but not wholly due to the 9% fall in the Shanghai share market on the Tuesday, the 27th of February, was more about a re-evaluation or a reassessment by investors that that process of pricing out any kind of risk at all had gone too far than it was about any ominous warning clouds on the international investment horizon. But the point I want to make again before turning to focus on the outlook for the domestic economy is that to an extent that is probably still not obvious by the way in which the media and many economists present stories about the global economy. The things that really matter to the growth in the global economy are things that are happening in the developing world rather than only being determined by what happens on Wall Street or in Frankfurt or in Japan, and that the impact of things in the developing world goes beyond merely the fact that they're growing at a rapid pace, but extends to the discipline that they're imposing on the setting of prices and labour costs in the rich world, and the fact that they are operating as a supply of capital. And so the risks to continued growth in the world economy really come down not so much to is Wall Street overvalued or is the yen egregiously undervalued, but are there things likely to happen in the global political environment that would interrupt or impede the discipline that developing countries impose on the price and wage-setting behaviour of firms and workers in the rich world, or would interrupt the supply of capital from the developing world to the rich world. And therefore, I would say, and I'll just leave it before going on, that the biggest threats are probably around the risk of a rise in protectionist sentiment, particularly in the United States, following last November's congressional elections that sent a suite of unabashed protectionists to Washington and to the chairs of influential congressional committees, which probably has parallels in Europe as well, and that probably represents the biggest risk to the kind of global economy that's unfolded in recent years. Of course, there's a lot of focus on the role that both India and China are playing there, and while India has done particularly well, the point I want to make here is that at 9% growth, India is seeing 6% inflation and a trade deficit, while China is, with 10% growth, seeing 2% inflation and rising trade surpluses. The message here is that at 9%, India is probably exceeding its speed limit and will be forced to slow down, whereas at 10% growth, China's probably cruising at its economic speed limit. It may be, as the National People's Congress was told last week, exceeding its environmental speed limit, but it's unlikely to be brought slowing down dramatically by monetary policy or fiscal policy measures in a way that I suspect is becoming increasingly likely in India. But to the extent that these economies can keep growing, the likelihood is, as they move into the range of income per head at which, if the experience of other countries is any guide, consumption of energy and metals will rise faster than income as a growing proportion of the population is able for the first time to buy metal and energy intensive consumer goods, such as household appliances and motor vehicles, that the demand for commodities is going to continue to rise very strongly for at least another decade. That, of course, doesn't necessarily mean that commodity prices are going to keep rising, as they've been doing over the last 3 years, because there is a supply side to commodity markets as well as a demand side, and the supply side is now beginning to respond, somewhat belatedly, to the prospect of very strong demand for commodities from countries like China and other emerging markets. In most cases, I think commodity prices have passed their peaks in recent months, with the possible exception of gold and oil, where there's no obvious new supply coming on stream. But in the case of other metals and commodities, the likelihood is that increases in supply will be sufficient to absorb much of the growth in demand, and thus commodity prices shouldn't be expected to rise a great deal further. The Australian economy has done remarkably well over the last 15 years, and I'm sure we'll hear that repeated plenty of times over the next 8 months or so until the next federal election. And if you were to have asked 15 years ago, what would you like economic policy to have achieved, it would be pretty hard-pressed. You would have been hard-pressed to go past, can we go for 15 years without recession, please? And that's what Australia has done. We've gone longer without two or more consecutive quarters of negative growth since quarterly data were first collected in 1959, and indeed based on annual data, probably longer than at any time since Federation. You would have asked in an ideal world for full employment, and at less than 5% in the past 12 months, that's what we've had. And while it's true that unemployment rates were lower than that in the 50s and 60s, that was partly because up to a third of the potential workforce was effectively excluded from participation in the labour market. So now that those barriers to married women's employment in particular are not eliminated, but less severe than they used to be then, it's also a credit-worthy point that employment is a record high of the working age population. And contrary to what you might have feared if you had been confident 5 or 10 years ago that we'd get the unemployment rate down to less than 5%, we haven't seen the kind of surges of inflation or interest rates that have typically accompanied the economy operating as close to full employment as we've been in the past year. True, inflation and interest rates have risen since 2002, but they remain very low by historical standards. Corporate profits are at a record high as a proportion of national income, and that in turn means that although the stock market has, until the last 2 weeks, been striking new highs almost at daily intervals, scaled against the earnings which companies are reporting, it couldn't be said that the Australian share market is in any fundamental sense overvalued. The balance sheet of corporate Australia is in excellent shape, with the capacity to pay interest 3 times as strong as it was 15 years ago, and the debt-to-equity ratio half what it was 15 years ago. And the balance sheet of the public sector, likewise, is in excellent shape. Indeed, I'm inclined to think that the enthusiasm for eliminating public debt, and this is not specifically a comment about Tasmania, has been taken further than perhaps it should be. There's no principle of economics or public finance that I'm aware of that says the optimal level of debt for a government is zero, any more than the optimal level of debt for a household or a business is zero. Indeed, I work for an organisation that depends on persuading people that the optimal level of debt is a positive number. And I suspect that the optimal level of debt for Tasmania, whatever it is smaller proportionately than it is for some other states because Tasmania's economy is more narrowly based and more volatile. But I wouldn't be discouraging the Treasurer if I were giving him advice from contemplating some level of borrowing to fund part of the cost of the acute care hospital that's to be built here, nor would I dissuade him from funding the other part of it by sales of government business enterprises along the same lines that his colleagues in Queensland have done very successfully in the last few months or so, and that money in Queensland, of course, is being put into water infrastructure. For all of these achievements that the Australian economy has recorded over the last 15 years, it's worth noting that while politicians will claim the lion's share of the credit for it, they've been achieved in circumstances globally that have been much more conducive to good economic results in Australia than during the 70s and 80s. In particular, the last 15 years have seen stronger and less volatile growth in the world economy than the 70s and 80s did, and it's been much easier for Australia to achieve low inflation and low interest rates when all of our peer group have been achieving the same thing. Perhaps more importantly than anything else, the last 15 years have seen a decisive reversal of what was, for most of the 20th century, the single most adverse trend in our international economic environment, the tendency in all but a couple of the previous 90 years for the prices of the things that Australia exports, mainly commodities, to fall relative to the prices of the things that we import, mainly manufactured goods and services. And the turnaround in the terms of trade, the ratio of our export to import prices, has boosted Australia's disposable income by around 1% per annum over the course of this decade, or by an average of $3,300 for each and every Australian per annum. In those circumstances, if Australia couldn't achieve continued economic growth, low unemployment and low inflation, there would have to be some very serious questions being asked about the quality of economic management in Canberra and in other parts of the country. In fact, there are at least two aspects of Australia's economic performance in the last 5 years that do seem disturbing. One is that in the face of what ought to have been extraordinarily friendly conditions from the perspective of Australian exports, our export volume performance, that is stripped of the impact of rising prices for mineral and energy commodities, has been abysmal. Over the last 5 years, the rate of growth in the volume of Australian exports has been lower than during any five-year period since the late 1950s. To some extent, that reflects capacity constraints in the resources sector itself, which hopefully now are being alleviated. To some extent, it reflects the impact of a strong dollar that's a byproduct of the commodity boom on the international competitiveness of sectors such as manufacturing, agriculture and tourism. But even allowing for those well-rehearsed excuses, it's hard to defend a situation in which, while the rest of the world has seen exports rising as a proportion of national income, in circumstances which have been incredibly favourable to this country's pattern of exports, the share of exports in our national income is lower than it was 15 years ago. The other disappointing aspect of Australia's economic performance, which wasn't altered by last week's national accounts, is the deterioration in our productivity performance. One of the main fundamental reasons why Australia's economy did well in the 1990s, before the commodity boom emerged on the scene, was that productivity growth in Australia was much more rapid in that decade than it had been during the previous 30 or 40 years, and more rapid than it was in most other overseas countries. So that during the 1990s, for example, the level of productivity in Australia, as a proportion of the US as a rough benchmark for best practice, rose from about 80% to 88% by the end of that decade. There are some good reasons, and the Productivity Commission last week reiterated them, why it would be unrealistic to expect the level of productivity in Australia ever to attain that in the United States. They had to do with scale and distance and transport costs and so forth. But what's really disappointing is that having made such good progress in the 1990s, we have since seen our productivity growth rate fall below that of the United States and our level of productivity fall back to 82% where we were in 1992. I suspect there are three reasons for that. One of them is not that the mining industry has seen an odd divergence between employment and output. It's certainly true that an awful lot of people have been employed in the mining sector digging new or bigger holes over the last 5 years without any valuable rocks yet coming out of those holes that gets measured as output. But although productivity in the mining industry has therefore deteriorated quite sharply, when you take mining out of the total, remembering that mining is only 5% of national GDP. The overall productivity growth rate has still been dismal compared with the 90s. One of the reasons is probably that with companies now making so much money, the incentive to search for productivity gains has been diminished. A second and probably the most important reason is that there have been almost no productivity-enhancing reforms of the sort that we saw in the 80s and early 90s since about 1998. Instead, what we've got is a long list of sectors ranging from pharmacists and news agencies at the small end to agricultural marketing, international aviation, health insurance, education and health itself at the big end, which for political reasons have been exempted from productivity-enhancing reforms, and it's good to see that state governments at least are starting to put some of these things back on the agenda again. And the third reason, which I find hard to quantify, but I nonetheless think is important, is that instead of productivity-enhancing reforms in the last 6 years, what we've had is a tidal wave of productivity-stifling legislation and regulation, ostensibly with the aims of enhancing national security, a term I always put in inverted commas, or standards of corporate governance. I suspect that none of that legislation has done much to improve national security or standards of corporate governance. The probability of any of us being killed in a terrorist attack, which remember is infinitesimally small compared with the risk of being killed in a car accident on the way to the airport, is not greatly reduced by having an army of people confiscating shaving cream or waving magic wands over your laptops. The purpose of most of that legislation, in my view, is A, to make people think that the risk of terrorism is worse than it actually is, or that of corporate fraud is worse than it actually is, so that they will be except extensions of financials of government intrusion into their lives that they would not otherwise accept, and reductions in their civil liberties that they would not otherwise accept, and C, to encourage people to think that should either of those events happen again, that they will believe that governments have done all they could to have prevented it, which in truth is probably close to zero. Instead, what that legislation has done, without doubt, is to mandate the employment of tens of thousands of people who do absolutely nothing of value themselves, but add to the cost and detract from the productivity of people who are seeking to do something useful, and as I say, for no ultimate result at all. The price we pay for that is evident in the deterioration in our productivity figures such as these. The economy is now bumping into capacity constraints, not only in the labour market, but in terms of other forms of capacity, other forms of ingredients for economic growth, such as idle plant and equipment, and outside of Sydney, vacant office space. Here in Hobart even, the office vacancy rate is now under 2%, which I believe is the lowest since figures have been collected in the early 1980s. And in the absence of any obvious new sources of economic growth, maybe we'll get some from exports, hopefully, as the mining investment boom starts to produce increased output. We're certainly getting some from state government infrastructure programs, as last week's national accounts revealed, and we may at some point get a bit of an upturn in housing. But aside from those factors and the hoped-for breaking of the drought, it's difficult to see economic growth exceeding 3% on a sustained basis going forward. It's difficult to see the unemployment rate falling much further, and it's difficult to see the underlying inflation rate, as distinct from the headline inflation rate, falling much below about 2.75% per annum over the next couple of years, which means that the Reserve Bank will have a bias towards tightening monetary policy for the foreseeable future. That doesn't rule out the possibility that in 2008 the cash rate could fall by, say, half a percentage point, although that would still leave the cash rate on the tight side of neutral, which the Reserve Bank puts at around 5.5%. And as Glenn Stevens, the governor of the Reserve Bank, said in Perth a few weeks ago, any attempt, any sign that the economy was likely to grow at above its speed limit of about 3% might produce a different outlook for interest rates going forward. He didn't say, because the Reserve Bank doesn't like to get into these kind of arguments, that any pre-election tax cuts or spending increases on the scale that preceded the last two elections would produce that result. But I certainly have no doubt that if the government thinks it can retrieve its position in the polls by going on the kind of spending or tax-cutting spree that it has done in 2001 or 2004, the result would be significantly higher interest rates. One of the other implications of the way in which the commodity boom and the growth of developing countries is driving the Australian economy now is that different parts of the country will inevitably be growing at different rates. Because Western Australia and the Northern Territory and to some extent Queensland have much bigger mining sectors than other parts of the country, they're bound to be doing better in circumstances such as these. That impact on the pattern of growth across the country is reinforced in a way that is perhaps less well appreciated by the fact that a byproduct of the commodities boom is that the dollar is higher than it would otherwise be, and that works to the detriment of those parts of the country which have an above average share of their economies taken up by manufacturing, agriculture and tourism. And it just so happens that the state which has the biggest share of manufacturing plus agriculture is Tasmania. So Tasmania is disadvantaged not only by having a relatively small mining sector, but also by having an above average manufacturing and agricultural sector as a proportion of its economy. Now, this is, of course, the opposite of the way things were applying in 2000-2001 when the distribution of economic activity in Tasmania worked to this state's advantage and when Western Australia in particular actually experienced negative growth in this year. What's not unusual is that there are differences between the fastest and slowest growing states. Indeed, there have always been differences of at least 4 percentage points in most years between the fastest and slowest growing states. The difference in 2006 was actually smaller than it has been on average over the last 20 years, and state and treasury forecasts suggest that the difference will be smaller over the next 4 years than it has been over the last four. What is unusual about the current state of affairs is that it's New South Wales that's coming last. And since most of our media and most of our financial commentary emanates from Sydney, it's the fact that Sydney is at the bottom of the pile that is the reason why there is so much attention to this twin-track pattern of growth across the Australian economy. Sydney, of course, is used to being at the top of the pile and thinks it deserves to be there by some kind of God-given right rather than as a result of its economic performance. That's why they insist that we celebrate the foundation of their city as our national day, and why they insist on telling our kids that Captain Cook discovered the country when all he really discovered was the site of Sydney Airport, and the most important parts of the country were, of course, discovered by Abel Tasman 128 years earlier. In Sydney, they also think, or at least the Treasurer of New South Wales thinks, that monetary policy should be set with Sydney's interests uppermost in mind, which is why Michael Costa says that the Treasurer, the Federal Treasurer, ought to intervene in the Reserve Bank Board's decision-making in order to stop it from raising rates in ways that hurt Sydney more than anywhere else, because people in Sydney have to have bigger mortgages in order to buy the average-priced house in Sydney. In fact, New South Wales should be doing better than most other southeast states because they are, after all, the second biggest exporter of Australia's largest commodity export, namely coal, whereas Victoria, South Australia and Tasmania have no really significant commodity export bases at all. The reason why New South Wales is doing worse than any other state are actually a constellation of reasons manufactured in Sydney, centred around the fact that for 10 years New South Wales had a government that was basically opposed to economic and particularly population growth, as encapsulated in Bob Carr's repeated statement that Sydney was full, and in a classic piece of the same kind of Sydney-centric arrogance that I was describing before, said that that therefore meant that the rest of Australia should have a lower migration intake as well. And if you spend 10 years saying that you really would rather people interested in economic or population and growth that go to some other part of the country or not come here at all, as Bob Carr did, then eventually folks get the message. And New South Wales's biggest problem now is that its population growth rate is barely half the national average, and therefore that anything that depends on population growth, such as retail sales, housing starts or motor vehicles, is suffering relative to the rest of the country. To their credit, the Premier and Treasurer of New South Wales, who are facing an election in 2 weeks' time, have reversed everything that distinguished Bob Carr's government from other Labor governments around the country, and the gap between economic and population growth in New South Wales and other states is narrowing. But as any Tasmanian, Victorian or South Australian could tell the citizens of New South Wales, you don't make up for a decade of bad policy by 2 years of moderately good policy. It takes considerably longer than that for the benefits of hard decisions actually to show up. I was going to go on and say something about the Tasmanian economy, but partly because it's 5-2 and partly because, other than having some scepticism about whether whether we'll actually get GSP growth of 2.75% in 2006-07, there's not a great deal that I would disagree with in terms of the Treasurer's analysis of the Tasmanian economy. So perhaps, Peter, I'll stop at that point, and hopefully we've left time for at least a couple of questions.